A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving deep, and I mean really deep, into the mind of René Descartes, often called the father of modern philosophy. We're tackling his big ones, the Discourse on Method and the Meditations on First Philosophy.
Yeah, and it's quite a journey he takes us on. His goal was, well, incredibly ambitious. He wasn't just trying to add another opinion to the pile. He wanted rock solid, absolutely certain knowledge.
Something unshakable, right?
Exactly. A foundation that no amount of skepticism could possibly tear down. He saw all the contradictions in the philosophy of his day and just wasn't satisfied.
And that's why he still matters so much today, isn't it? I mean, We're constantly wrestling with what's true, what we can really know.
Yeah.
Our senses fool us. Experts disagree. Online information is, well, you know.
Uh-huh.
Descartes basically gives us a toolkit for thinking for ourselves, for achieving a kind of intellectual independence.
He really does. So let's talk about the man himself. René Descartes, born 1596. He lived during this incredible time, the Scientific Revolution, and he wasn't just a philosopher.
Right, that's key. He was also a groundbreaking mathematician. Analytical geometry, you know, the coordinate system, X and Y axes, that was him, connecting algebra and geometry.
Which tells you a lot about how his mind worked. He craved the kind of certainty and rigor you find in mathematics.
And he looked at philosophy and saw, well, not that.
Definitely not. He saw arguments based on tradition, on ancient authorities, often conflicting. Compared to math, it seemed like shaky ground. So he decided, quite radically, to just start over.
From scratch.
Pretty much. To build philosophy on a new, rational foundation, using reason alone, not relying on what previous thinkers had said.
Okay, so that's the setup.
Yeah.
Let's trace that path. These works together, they kind of guide you through this process, from total doubt to finding certainty.
It starts with what he called methodological doubt. And this isn't just, you know, wondering if you left the stove on. This is hyperbolic doubt. Extreme.
Hyperbolic. Meaning exaggerated.
Kind of. He deliberately takes doubt as far as it can possibly go. He says, okay, let's question everything. Our senses, do they ever trick us? Yes. So maybe they always trick us.
Okay.
What about memories? Could they be false? Sure. Even mathematical truths like 2 + 3 = 5. Could some powerful being be deceiving me about even that?
Wow. Okay. Oh, that sounds destabilizing. How is that useful? Isn't that just getting lost in skepticism?
But see, the doubt is a method. It's a tool. He's using it strategically, like a demolition crew clearing a site before building something new. He wants to find the one thing, if anything, that cannot be doubted no matter what.
The bedrock.
Precisely. And that leads him to his famous breakthrough. Even if he doubts everything, even if some evil demon is tricking him about the existence of the world, The very act of doubting or being tricked proves that he, the thinker, must exist to be doing the doubting or the being tricked.
Ah, the cogito.
Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. That's the one indubitable truth he finds.
Even if everything else is an illusion, the thinking itself proves the existence of the thinker.
Exactly. He calls the self a res cogitans, a thinking thing. And that becomes his Archimedean point, the firm spot from which he can try to rebuild all of knowledge.
So from just I exist as a thinking thing, he tries to get back everything else, the external world, God.
Yep. It's an amazing philosophical construction project. He argues from the contents of his own mind, specifically the idea of a perfect God to prove God exists. And because God is perfect, God wouldn't be a deceiver.
So God guarantees that his clear and distinct perceptions about the world are actually reliable.
That's the logic. It allows him to eventually confirm the existence of the external world and leads to his famous distinction between mind and body.
Okay, before we get to God and mind-body, let's back up to the Discourse on Method. That's where he lays out the how-to part, right?
Yeah.
The rules for thinking properly.
Exactly. It's like the instruction manual. In part one, he talks about his own education, how even though he studied everything, he felt full of doubts and errors, except in mathematics.
So he decided book learning wasn't the answer.
Right. He decided to look within himself and travel, learn from the book of the world, but most importantly, to follow a strict method. Which brings us to part two and the four rules.
These are super famous and actually really practical.
They are. Rule number one, clarity. Basically, don't accept anything as true unless you clearly and distinctly perceive it to be so. No room for doubt. If you're not sure, suspend judgment.
Makes sense. Avoid jumping to conclusions.
Rule two, analysis. Break down complex problems into their smallest, simplest parts. You know, standard problem solving, really.
Like debugging code or diagnosing an illness. You isolate the components.
Precisely. Rule 3. Order, or synthesis, start with the simplest things, the things you understand clearly, and then build up step by step towards understanding the more complex things. Don't jump ahead.
Logical progression.
And rule 4, enumeration. Be thorough. Review everything so completely that you're certain you haven't missed anything. Check your work, basically.
It's a very methodical, well, it's in the name, isn't it?
Yeah.
A very structured way to approach knowledge.
Definitely inspired by the rigor of geometric proofs. Okay, so he has his method. Now, in the meditations, he puts it into action. He actually performs the doubt.
This is where it gets really intense. Meditation eye.
He unleashes the doubt in stages. First, the senses. He notes, look, sometimes my senses deceive me. A distant tower might look round but be square up close. A stick in water looks bent.
Yeah, optical illusions, things like that.
So, since they sometimes deceive us, we can't absolutely trust them all the time. Maybe they're always deceiving us in subtle ways.
Okay, a bit extreme, but I see the methodological point. What's next?
The dream argument. This is a classic. How can you be absolutely certain right now that you're not dreaming? Dreams can feel incredibly real.
Uh-oh. Yeah, that's tricky. There's no definitive test, is there?
Descartes says there isn't. If you can't be 100% sure you're not dreaming, then everything you perceive about the external world, your hands, this room, the sky, could be part of the dream. So the existence of the physical world is now in doubt.
That's a big step. But wait, even in a dream, doesn't 2 + 3 still equal 5? Aren't mathematical truths safe?
This is where he plays his trump card of doubt. Hmm. The malicious demon, or evil genius hypothesis.
Sounds ominous.
It is. He says, what if there's an incredibly powerful, clever, evil being whose sole purpose is to deceive me about absolutely everything, making me think 2 + 3 = 5 when it's really something else, making me think I have a body when I don't.
Wow. So this demon could be faking everything, even logic itself.
That's the hypothesis. It's the ultimate skeptical challenge. If you accept this possibility, almost nothing seems certain anymore, except...
Except the Capito. If the demon is deceiving me, then I must exist to be deceived.
Bingo. That's meditation too. The emergence of the self from the depths of doubt. I am, I exist, is necessarily true every time that I pronounce it.
And he uses that wax example here too, right? To show reason is superior to senses.
Yes, the wax example. It's brilliant. Take a piece of beeswax. Your senses tell you its properties. It smells like honey, it's hard, cold, has a certain shape and color.
Okay.
Now, bring it near a fire. What happens? The smell goes away, the color changes, the shape melts, it becomes hot and liquid. Every single sensory property has changed.
Right.
Yet, you know, you understand that it's the same wax, that knowledge doesn't come from your senses, they're reporting completely different things. It comes from your mind, your intellect, which grasps the underlying nature of the wax as something extended and changeable.
So the real essence is grasped by reason. Not by sight or touch.
Precisely. Knowledge comes from the mind inspecting its ideas. Okay, so he's established the thinking self. Now he needs to get the world back.
Which brings us to God in Meditation 3. How does that argument work again? It's sometimes called the trademark argument.
Yeah. He looks inside his own mind and finds various ideas. Ideas of tables, chairs, maybe unicorns. But also the idea of a perfect being. Infinite, all-knowing, all-powerful God.
Okay, he has the idea.
But then he asks, where did that specific idea come from? He argues that he himself is imperfect and finite, so he couldn't have invented the idea of infinite perfection on his own. An effect can't be greater than its cause.
So the idea of a perfect God must have been implanted in him by a perfect God, like an artist signing their work.
That's the analogy, yeah, the trademark left by the creator. So he concludes God must exist.
And a perfect God wouldn't be a deceiver.
Correct, which is crucial. If God exists and isn't malicious, then God wouldn't systematically deceive him about everything. This allows Descartes to start trusting his clear and distinct perceptions again, at least to some extent.
But hang on, if God is perfect and not a deceiver, why do we make mistakes? Why do we get things wrong all the time? That's meditation 3, right?
Right, the problem of error. His answer is quite clever. He says error doesn't come from God. It comes from a mismatch between our faculties. We have intellect. Our ability to understand, which is finite and limited.
Okay.
But we also have free will, our ability to choose, to affirm or deny, which Descartes says is basically infinite. We can choose to believe anything we want.
So error happens when our infinite free will rushes ahead and makes judgments about things. Our finite intellect doesn't fully understand clearly and distinctly.
Exactly. We jump to conclusions. The solution, restrain your will. only assent to beliefs that your intellect perceives with that absolute clarity and distinctness he talked about in his method.
Makes sense. So God gives us the tools, but we misuse them.
That's the idea. And this finally leads him, in Meditation the Sixth, back to the external world and his famous mind-body dualism. Since God guarantees his clear perceptions, and he clearly perceives himself as a thinking thing and his body as an extended non-thinking thing, and he can conceive of them existing apart.
He concludes they are fundamentally distinct substances. Mind, res cogitans, is unextended thinking stuff. Body, res extensa, is extended, physical, mechanical stuff.
Yep. They interact somehow, but they are two different kinds of reality, and that split has had massive consequences for philosophy and science ever since.
Okay, let's pull back and look at the big themes here. What are the major takeaways?
Well, first, methodological skepticism. It's crucial to see doubt not as destructive, but as a constructive tool to clear away biases, especially those unquestioned beliefs we pick up growing up.
Which feels incredibly relevant today. With sorting through information online, we need that rigorous doubt filter.
Absolutely. Second, the emphasis on rationalism over empiricism. For Descartes, reason is the ultimate source of reliable knowledge, not the senses. The mind grasps the true nature of things, like with the wax. Senses only give us the surface.
A reminder to look deeper than appearances,
yeah.
For sure.
Third, the turn to the subject. This is huge. Philosophy before often started with the world, or God, or ancient texts. Descartes flips it. He starts with the individual thinking self, the I, as the foundation.
That's really empowering, isn't it? Locating the start of knowledge within your own consciousness, it champions introspection.
It really does. And finally, Descartes wasn't just doing abstract theory. He believed in the practical benefits of knowledge. He famously said his method could help make humans masters and possessors of nature.
Connecting rigorous thinking to real-world progress, like in medicine or technology.
Exactly. He saw a practical payoff to getting the foundations right.
And the books are filled with lines that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, number one is cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, the ultimate statement of self-awareness as proof of existence.
Can't argue with that one while you're arguing. I also like the one from the discourse. It is not sufficient to have a good mind. The main thing is to use it well.
Yes. It's not just about raw intelligence. It's about applying it methodically with discipline.
And the core principle of his doubt. I should hold back my assent from opinions which are not completely certain and indubitable just as carefully as I do from those which are patently false.
That's the standard of certainty, he set. If there's any room for doubt, don't accept it as knowledge. It's incredibly demanding.
And his definition of the self isn't just about logic, is it? It's broader.
Right. In Meditation 2, he says, I am a thing that thinks, that is to say, that doubts, affirms, denies, is willing, is unwilling. Thinking includes feeling, willing, imagining the whole spectrum of consciousness.
So how can we, you know, actually use these ideas day to day?
Well, the four rules are a great critical thinking framework. Use clarity. Demand clear evidence before believing something, especially online or in the news. Use analysis. Break down big, overwhelming problems or decisions into smaller parts.
And order an enumeration for projects, right? Start simple, build up, review carefully. It's basically good project management.
It really is. And apply that standard of clarity and distinctness.
Question assumptions. If an argument or explanation seems fuzzy or relies on shaky premises, withhold your full agreement. Be intellectually rigorous.
What about dealing with uncertainty in life, since absolute certainty is hard to come by outside of philosophy class?
Descartes had advice there too, his provisional morality. He said, while you're searching for truth, you still have to live. So act decisively based on the best available opinions, even if they aren't perfectly certain. Like a traveler lost in a forest should pick one direction and stick to it rather than wandering in circles.
Don't get paralyzed by doubt in everyday life. Focus on controlling your own choices and desires rather than trying to change external circumstances you can't control.
Exactly. It's quite practical advice.
Thinking about the whole thing, what stands out most to you now? For me, it's how deeply that mind-body dualism is still baked into our thinking. When we debate artificial intelligence, can a machine really think or just simulate it? Does it have consciousness? We're still wrestling with Descartes' separation of thinking substance from physical substance. It's a question that won't go away.
That's a great point. What about you? What's your big takeaway?
I think it's the sheer empowerment of his message. He essentially tells every individual, You have the capacity within your own reason to figure things out, to challenge authority, to build knowledge from the ground up. He teaches how to think critically and fearlessly. That feels incredibly valuable, always.
A call for intellectual autonomy. Mm. It really is a foundation of modern thought.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.